Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Lee Patel, author of No Study Without Struggle, Confronting Settler Colonialism in Academia, out now from Basic Books. Whew, it is a powerful, polyphonic, and personal discussion of the bleak relationship between settler colonialism and higher education in this country as it stands today. As told by Patel, who is a respected transdisciplinary scholar who studied education, protest movements, decolonization, intersectionality, and critical race theory. She sees the relationship between study and struggle, between canon and rebellion, as an academic and also as an activist. Here's a bit of Kirkus's review of No Study Without Struggle. Settler colonialism is based on the logic of owning land, Patel writes, and that there is never enough land to satisfy the landowner's thirst. Both by design and due to institutional half-measures, American educational systems have largely failed to redress this malign history. Quote, whenever education, specifically higher education, has been made to reckon with its settler colonial structure, it has been largely through the struggles of those cast underneath the heel of oppression, fueled by their own formations to study, end quote. Regarding efforts at diversity, which she discusses in detail, she notes, gift economies are a colonial structure that imagines some people as worthy only through the benevolence of people with higher status. Despite such public-facing efforts, prominent universities have not properly addressed persistent patterns of class and race-based favoritism, to which Patel responds with justified, terse fury, reminding readers how many of these institutions were built by slaves. At the same time, the author celebrates a counter-narrative of persistent patterns of protests and alternative learning modes by indigenous people, people of color, and LGBTQ+ communities. Learning has never yielded fully to the settler project of colonization of the mind, Patel writes. Lee Patel is the former Associate Dean for Equity and Justice in Education at the University of Pittsburgh and a highly regarded speaker and scholar across the fields of education, ethnic studies, critical higher education studies, and literacy. And I am thrilled to be speaking with her after the break.
This message is brought to you by Beatrice E. Ruiz Silva, author of Carta de Tita Betty para mi nieto Leo. With this book, Ruiz Silva shows some of the traditions of her Mexican upbringing to the bilingual Mexican-American youth. Our reviewer called Carta de Tita Betty para mi nieto Leo, quote, an amusing kids' book that reveals the wisdom behind Spanish adages. In a series of Spanish language letters to her grandson, who lives in an English-Spanish bilingual household, Ruiz Silva shares lessons gleaned from common adages in her native Mexico. Spanish-speaking children will find this text accessible and instructional, as will kids learning Spanish as a second language, end quote. In the summer of 2019, Carta de Tita Betty para mi nieto Leo was given to children who participated in the immersion program for students of Mexican origin organized by the Mexican consulates in the U.S. You can find Carta de Tita Betty para mi nieto Leo on Amazon in paperback, audio, and ebook. This message is brought to you by Deborah Nettleman, author of What We Take for Truth. What We Take for Truth is the story of a young woman who finds her strength when the world around her crumbles. At its height, the world of logging in the Pacific Northwest was both brutal and beautiful. When the conservation movement sent protesters into the woods and the government began to place the needs of a small, shy bird above those of families dependent on the harvest of those woods, the conflicts that erupted were fierce and heartbreaking. In Kirkus's starred review of What We Take for Truth, our reviewer praised the book as, quote, an impressive environmental tale with an engaging heroine from a talented new novelist. It is a late coming-of-age tale about Grace, a wonderfully drawn character, a young woman who doesn't want to take sides, end quote. What We Take for Truth won the 2019 Sarton Women's Book Award for Historical Fiction and was included in Kirkus's Best Books of 2019. Readers can find What We Take for Truth on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online retailers in ebook, paperback, and audiobook.
Welcome, Lee, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be in conversation with you today.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. No study without struggle. Confronting settler colonialism in higher education affected me deeply. I think this is a very powerful book that deserves a wide readership, and I'm thrilled for the chance to get to dig in a little bit with you.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be on the podcast and grateful for all of the work that Kirkus does to, you know, delve deeply into books and tell people about them.
All right, so let's do both. Now, may we start with settler colonialism? I'm perceiving that this is a concept that's being spoken about with more frequency in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has been spoken and uttered more frequently in recent years. It has a history of at least three decades, probably four, just in terms of being published. Mm-hmm. But it's become more and more common in that sense, used more outside of academic halls and college courses. It's become a really important term for understanding really this mix of, for the United States, the mixture of the Holocaust of slavery and then the conjoined constant need to erase indigeneity.
Right, right. Okay. So, and that's like for listeners who may not be familiar with the words or maybe are just starting to hear this come up, could we dig in a little bit deeper to that? Would you share a little bit about what settler colonialism, what it means and what it runs on?
Sure. Great question. So I know that when I was in K-12 schooling, I had an image when colonialism would come up, I would think of like some royalty in a country.
Yeah.
And that person's sending their minions to like, go get the spice, go get the coffee, tea, sugar, or other things, bring them back here. Mm. And settler colonialism is a bit different in that there's still extraction going on, like of that coffee, tea, spices, sugar, that there's still extraction, but land is also extracted. And how that happens in settler colonialism is like, let's say I'm the royalty. I'm the queen. I say, go over there and check out that space for me. And my people come back and tell me, this is an amazing space. I'm like, that's great. Now that belongs to me. So there's the colonialism, a form of colonialism where people arrive to a land that is not their homeland and they stay. And what that means is reconfiguring relationships to just about everything, but primarily to land. Mm. In settler colonialism, land is what's most desired, and property and land is what's most desired. And so land stops being a life form in and of itself. It instead turns into plots of land to be owned. Mm-hmm. And so the land is really important. But for me, as this queen, that's mine now, I have a couple things that I also need besides saying, this is my land and sticking my flag in the land. Indigenous people really get in the way of me claiming that's my land. So I need to do everything I can physically, psychically, mentally to erase indigeneity. Mm. And if to when talking about them in the past. They're gone. Hmm. And as a settler who's desiring to build land and property, I want to grow my wealth, but I don't want to do the work myself. So chattel slavery comes in as an unfortunate, necessary part of settler colonialism as unpaid labor through the form of enslaved peoples. And we know that to be more generally, the transatlantic slave system that was crucial to the origins of the nation. So all those work together as a structure of settler colonialism.
Right. So just to recap, you as queen, you send in your people out there, they're going to claim that land.
they're going to kill or erase, but through assimilation or otherwise, the indigenous peoples who formerly were the stewards of that land. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, you're going to have your people import actual human beings who will be treated as chattel to work the land and make it more profitable for you.
Right. It needs all of those combined. That was a great recap. Thank you.
It's a great thank you for the compliment, but, you know, a really weighty, meaty idea, almost staggering in how enormously vile it all sounds, you know, like just to speak the words of what's true.
Yeah, I agree. I remember the first time I heard the term from my friend and colleague, Eve Tuck, It kind of blew my hair back on my head. I was like, oh, that all makes sense. And I can see how all of those need each other for the entire project to exist.
Okay, so we've got settler colonialism. What is academia in relationship to settler colonialism, or vice versa?
Mm-hmm. So the formation of the United States, education has always been a component of that. And higher education, as I'm sure you and other listeners know, first came into existence, formal education, as elite institutions for white men. Mm. And those are our Ivy League schools. And where would we be without the work of Craig Stephen Wilder, whose book Ebony and Ivy very carefully traces the history of the Holocaust of slavery and how much we would not have these Ivy League colleges without that free labor, that stolen labor. And so higher education is looked like in the most obvious fashion in that way. But it's also important to remember that public, private colleges and universities, all of them in a settler colony, they reside on indigenous lands. Mm. So there's been some kind of removal and multiple forms, which you were naming, Megan. They are removal of human beings who are indigenous. There's the removal of their practices and culture. There's, you mentioned assimilation. There's removal of culture by sending Indian children to boarding schools, in which the first thing that happened to them was that their hair was cut off. Mm. And in many Native tribes and nations, hair is such an important part of culture and one's identity and one's collective identity. So many of these Indigenous children, when they were sent to an Indian boarding school and had their hair cut, they thought they were orphans, because that meant symbolically and psychically to them that their family was dead.
Yeah.
So higher education has participated in this project. And in this sense, I would say, you kind of come by it honestly. We kind of come by it honestly in that it was seeded through the states, United States formation. Mm-hmm. And as we know, the Declaration of Independence, beautiful document that it is written for and by white land-owning men and property-owning men, property meaning owning, they were enslavers also. So the contradictions are kind of sewn into both the nation and higher education.
Thank you for that answer. You write in this book that you have long had an ambiguous relationship with formal education. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that relationship?
Sure. So I have an absolute fascination with learning. I love it. I know it's really uncomfortable. I know when I'm learning something, I can't be in that high form tilt practice for a long time because it's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's absolutely exhausting. And learning also involves taking what we know, like if we have two hand grips on it, having one hand let go and reach out for something that we're not quite sure what it is or who will be after we've learned this, or while we're learning this new fact, paradigm, history, or hidden history would be a better way to put it.
Right.
So I have a deep, deep love of learning. Then I come into formal education. I'm thinking about when I was a middle school teacher, which remains my favorite job. Like, just, I laughed every single day when working with speakers. And they will, you know, the decibel level of them telling you their truth is like, okay, I can hear you just fine from like 6 feet away if you're screaming. But that's their ethos and I love it. So for me, it's like having to create rubrics, which create both a basement and a ceiling for what learning might occur in a project or in a themed set of weeks. That to me has been like, I really would rather not do that. I also know I could see, and this is really what led me to get a doctorate. I never planned on becoming a professor, but I could see the tracking happen with those seventh graders.
Yeah.
I could know them as the most brilliant people in my classroom and hear them being screamed at in classrooms next door to me. And so because of loving learning and loving being in relation with young people, it's kind of heartbreaking to see the tracking happen, the school prison nexus, and to see the racism fully alive and throttling along.
I'm going to take a pivot here to something I might have mentioned later in the conversation, but it's pinging for me right now. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of powerful thinkers who influence this book, like their influence is mighty. One of them is your mother. And for what it's worth, you just said that working in a middle school was a funny job. I'm sure it was. And also for this at funny, brilliant job, this is a funny, brilliant book. Like for the topic to be so weighty and to also have these moments where we find out that you can't call your mother during Days of Our Lives, which I appreciate. That's real. I wanted to ask you specifically if you would speak a little bit about the influence your mother had on your own ideas about or approaches to learning.
How much time do we have?
We got all day.
So my mother is an amazing connection to learning for me. She is truly the most autodidactic person I know. And what that means is, so she came to the United States in 1960, a good 5 years before the sanctioned migration of engineers and doc physicians and highly skilled professionals from Southeast Asia and South Asia. She preceded that wave, and she came to the United States without speaking a word of English and coming from a different alphabet system.
Yeah.
So street signs held no meaning for her. And she taught herself to speak English. I do think she gives Days of Our Lives a little bit too much credit for that. But she, but you know, that's what she says. I'll ask her, how did you do this? I watched Days of Our Lives and Wheel of Fortune in Jeopardy. So she taught herself that. When my father, through his own rocky ascendancy and then hitting a ceiling in management and becoming an important person in the workplace, when that hit a ceiling and his job started dwindling, and other factors came into play, she taught herself the craft of sewing and making these elaborate drapes and comforters for people. And she taught herself all of that. So to me, she embodies the power of learning and how transformative it is and how much self-determination can foment, can come to life, can flourish when we are learning. And I just would add that I told her, and she's read the part in the book where I discuss her in more detail than I ever have. She read it, that part. And I asked her, of course, if I could write about her in the book. And she said, okay, you do what you want, but be nice. And I said, okay. She's a very hard person not to be nice with them. And she read those pages and she finished. Well, first I read them aloud to her. And I finished reading that portion and I looked at her and I said, what do you think? And she said, you got it right. Everything you said is true. And then she said, can I have a copy? I said, Mama, you can have 500 copies. I'll buy them right now for you. So I learned so much from her. And I've told her, you are the most autodidactic person I know. And if I had not rushed to tell her what that meant, she would have taught it to herself.
Her response, as repeated by you, like, I drew my hand up to my heart just then.
Yeah.
She seems wonderful. And another person whose mind I really admire, another powerful thinker in this book, whose work you cite, is historian Robin Kelly. What in Robin Kelly's work drove your thinking about your own work?
Robin Kelly's work, I think, is so crucial. I think it would be a misnomer for me to say it's crucial right now. It's always been crucial. Mm-hmm. So as a careful and detailed historian of Black freedom struggles, Robin Kelly's work looks at many of the long, long train of Black freedom struggle, but looks at it in not a linear way because it doesn't really conform to a linear fashion. Mm. He examines freedom struggles well beyond nation state borders. And one of the things that I love about Robin Kelly's work is none of it is pessimistic. All of it is about how that struggle for freedom is a place in which so much is possible. And it may likely fail. So a thing that we may be involved with as a study group and an action group, the thing that we're trying to have happen, let's say canceling student debt, it might fail. It might get co-opted to the exact opposite of what we were trying to do. But if we stay close to the truth of why we're struggling, therein lies so much possibility and creates for multiple generations at the same time and in the past and in the future, it creates trace lines so that we know, like, oh, okay, it matters that freedom dreaming is something that's very present in jazz. It matters that that's part of the Black radical tradition. It matters that student mobilizations have been a constant feature in formal schooling. So Robin Kelly's work is just one of the best sources of studying freedom. The last thing I would say, like studying how to get free.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I would add is that I've heard from him and also heard from his sister that their mother would tell them that they always had to keep one foot firmly planted in reality, like be knowledgeable about the facts, about people's lives, and one other foot always dreaming a new world into existence. And that's the balance that I think is not too nihilistic. It's not nowhere near nihilistic. It's not pessimistic. It's full of this abolitionist kind of sense of like, well, let's try this.
Yeah.
All right. That went the opposite way than we thought it would. Let's try this.
Speaking of let's try this and nonlinear narratives, I kind of just got this, you know, inside the actor's studio, James Lipton mic drop kind of big question that I don't even know if it's fair. You want to try it?
Sure. Okay. I remember that. So he does hear some questions so well.
What's the role of love in the struggle for liberation in transforming systems of oppression?
Oh my gosh. James Lipton should have asked people that question. I mean, I should not speak about James Lipton, who's now an ancestor, but that is such a beautiful question.
Thank you.
So if we don't have love for learning, loving it so much that we refuse to confine it to any single space. If we don't have love for people, then we'll be a little bit more likely to say this school prison nexus thing, that seems fine. We're okay with throwing people away. We have to love humanity itself in order to really be with it. Because I'm sure as you know, and as it's as many people know, when we self-deputize ourselves, I always feel icky when I do that. This is what with my seventh grade. It's like, I don't care, chew gum, whatever. Like, I'm not going to spend my precious hours with you. So like, are you chewing gum? Don't you? And so having a love of learning, a love of humanity, and a love of possibility. Mm. So I also think about the ways in which in any number of institutions, it could be K-12 school, could be higher education, could be a corporation, like, I don't mind if others don't have, at the moment, a certain imagination for how we might do something differently other than keep reproducing who's at the top of society. But if we have a love for possibility, we definitely don't dampen the imagination of other people.
Whew. Please.
Nothing about freedom and study and struggle can happen without love.
How has your work as an organizer influenced you? What have you learned?
So much. Again, I'm like, edit. you know, it really raised me as an adult. And what I mean by that is that I learned I learned from no other place except for perhaps being with my mother as a child and being in a community when we would go to India to visit our family and just seeing this very communal existence that's very rare to find in the U.S. It exists, but it's harder to find. It's like you have to get out of the cul-de-sacs and the cookie cutter homes and the things. What organizing has taught me is that horizontal leadership is not only possible, it's been a hallmark of many freedom movements. So that applies to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, otherwise known as SNCC. It applies, certainly it's in part of the work we do is Education for Liberation. And it creates for brilliance, a certain amount of messiness, but also a constant question of, is this in our values? So if we go, if we make an exception to what we have named to be our values, everything we do, every action we take is always poured through this sieve, this filter of, is this our values? Are we off of our values?
Right.
So that's been a savior for me being in, you know, higher education is a strict hierarchy. I sometimes think of the Catholic Church and the military as the only other rivals it has. Such a strict hierarchy. And so in organizing spaces, particularly Education for Liberation, I've just seen that it doesn't have to be that way.
Okay. This is generating some kind of little spark for me around, say it was one of your, it's a middle schooler, or say, you know, it's somebody who doesn't have my privilege of being able to sit around all day and read great books, you know, cover to cover. Like how can people access the information in this book if they're not coming at it from an academic background, if they're not coming at it from a reader background?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this is one of the most important parts in writing for a wider audience.
Yeah.
The book coming from Beacon is, you know, that's a for a wide audience. And I did not want to write a book to other academics who already knew what settler colonialism was.
Right.
I think it's such a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool for looking at why are things the way that they are?
Right.
Does somebody need to have read a lot of things in order to approach this book? I hope not. Mm. And also, what a person might get from the reading in the book is, you know, like you bringing up my mother is thinking about that. How was I taught about love and who we love and how we love from my community, my parents, my teachers? Was love ever a presence in my education? Mm-hmm. So I think all of us can engage with those questions, and that's a fantastic place to begin. Like, I don't care if you haven't read other things. I mean, I would really love for everybody to read Robin Kelly. I think that would make the world a much better place. But, you know, everybody comes from relationships to being and to others. And so I think coming with the question of, was it a relationship of love? And just to bring in Toni Morrison here, so many of us, so many people, I don't want to imply like a certain us, so many people have experienced what Toni Morrison calls a thin love, and then says, and a thin love is no love at all. So is this love robust enough to handle learning that like sees the learning objective that might be written on the board or what a caregiver might say, and then goes way beyond it? Is our love bouncy and full enough to really appreciate that?
Well, now I've got my hair blown back. Lee, I am beyond, I don't have the words to state how grateful I am for this conversation. And I just want to give you my most hospitable closer, which is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the book or just to know?
Thank you, Megan. I think there's one other thing that I would like to add, because I think it might be a really logical thing for a reader of this book or of other works by other people who have an ambivalent relationship to formal education to ask, well, why then are you a professor? Mm. Are you a teacher? And my simple response is always this, like learning is so much bigger than all of these projects, the project of slavery, the project of settler colonialism, the project of reproducing social hierarchies. Learning is bigger. And I simply refuse to cede it to these structures.
Lee Patel, thank you so much, so very much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a delight to speak with you.
That was Lee Patel, author of No Study Without Struggle, Confronting Settler Colonialism in Academia, out now from Basic Books. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have Young Readers editor Vicky Smith, fiction editor Lori Muchnick, and editorial assistant Johanna Zwerner. Young Readers editor Laura Simeon and nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau are out of the office today. Starting with Vicky, what have you chosen for us?
I have this fabulous steampunk graphic novel. It's the sequel to a book that came out last summer called City of Secrets by Victoria Ying. And this book is called City of Illusions. And it's got a wicked complicated setup, which is, I think, appropriate to its steampunkness. But just understand that there are these three cities, and each one of these cities is very mechanical. You know, there's levers and gears and stuff, and you push buttons and things happen. But every single city has a humongous robot called a Megantic. And in the first book, the main characters, Hannah and Ever, found the Megantic of the city of Oscars. And in this book, they are in the city of Alexios, just visiting. And they happen upon a group of street urchins. One's a magician, and basically it's cover for pickpockets. It's very, very Oliver Twist-esque. And they happen upon this group of kids, and they learn in fairly short order first that Alexios is very much like Oscars in its sort of unusual attributes. And then they learn that the humongous villain of the first book, Vash, is in Alexios trying to consolidate the power that he's been seeking for all along. And what he wants now is the Megantic of the city of Alexios, which is in the control of these kids, except Vash being like wicked evil. He even says, "Muhahaha." It's very satisfying. He betrays the kids who thought that he was their savior. And, you know, things go badly. And Hannah and Ever need to convince these kids, who are very distrustful, that they are on their side and that by pulling together, they will be able to defeat Vash. And it's just incredibly satisfying. It's got Victoria Ying is a developmental artist for Disney and Sony, and she's got this incredibly cinematic style, these beautiful, very, very sort of 19th century, early 20th century European settings with great dresses, and, you know, the boys are wearing little newsboy watch caps and stuff like that. And then there's these humongous robots and gears and scary stuff. So it all comes together in this really fun adventure that is also, has a lot to say to our times too, and its sort of themes of unity. Really satisfying ending to this duology.
So I actually spoke to Victoria Ying about City of Secrets, the first book, and loved it so much and had such a wonderful time talking to her. She has this unbelievable ability to convey so much movement and so much energy with her illustrations. And like Vicky just said, you know, there's the steampunk sensibility and there's, you know, lots of gears and levers, and it's all kind of dizzying in the best way. And it was just such a pleasure to read and such a pleasure to speak with her about. She mentioned to me how she sort of had to reverse engineer this world because it was quite complicated. And I sort of wonder how that played out a little bit more in the second book. And I also remember talking to her about some of her literary inspirations. And she mentioned that Dickens was one of them. And that, of course, is very heavily inspired by the Victorian era. So I'm thrilled to hear that this one has come out, and I can't wait to read it.
You will love it.
Vicky's pick for the week is City of Illusion by Victoria Ying. Thank you, Vicky, for that choice. Next, we have Lori's pick. Lori, what's happening in fiction?
My pick is Wayward by Dana Spiotta, which is a really smart, spiky novel. I don't know if you guys know Spiotta. She's one of those writers who, I think all of her books have been finalists for really big literary prizes like the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, but they've never won. She's really well known in sort of literary circles, but maybe not to a broader audience. I feel like this book maybe will propel her to a larger readership. It's about a woman named Sam who lives in Syracuse, which is where Spiotta lives. She teaches writing at Syracuse University. But Sam is, she's living in a beautiful contemporary house in the suburbs of Syracuse with her husband, Matt, and their 16-year-old daughter. And she works part-time at a historic house that was the home of a 19th century feminist. You know, I think that whole area has, it's near Seneca Falls, and, you know, there are really lots of historic homes up there. So Sam works in one of these historic homes part-time, but she's got a lot of time on her hands. And then the 2016 election happens, and she's just kind of laid out. She's, you know, angry and upset. And she, I think she feels like her husband is not angry or upset enough, that the election is something that happened more strongly to her than to him, which, if you think about it, is probably true. So she joins an online group called Hardcore Hags, Harridans, and Harpies, and gets involved politically. But the big thing, the big event that kicks off the beginning of the book is, takes place a little while later. She sees a historic house in Syracuse. She's interested in architecture and history, and she likes to go to open houses just to kind of see the housing stock, get, you know, learn some history. It's kind of her hobby, as I think it is for a lot of people. And she just walks into a house that is beautiful and historic, but falling down, needs everything done to it. And so it doesn't cost very much. And she just on a whim decides to, you know, put a bid in on it and sign a contract for it without mentioning this to her husband. And what she realizes as she drives away is, oh, this means that I'm leaving my husband. Like, it, she wasn't looking to leave him. She just fell in love with this house and realized that this was her kind of blowing up her entire life. So the book goes on from there. And it also, we get some sections from the point of view of her 16-year-old daughter, who's just very smart and in high school and dealing with all of those things. But it's just a very quirky, in-depth dive into this woman's sensibility, and such a pleasure to read.
Well, Lori, this is yet another writer of grown-up fiction that I am unfamiliar with. That is my relationship with you. You tell me about all these books that I've never heard of. So I'm wondering, when you say that you really are hoping that this book is going to sort of get Spiotta over that hump into more widespread sort of acknowledgement of her excellence. Do you think that there is something special about her? Or is it just that she's been working long enough and has sort of been making inroads? I'm just wondering if there's something qualitatively different about this book as opposed to, you know, thematic and plot differences.
Kind of a combination of those things. I mean, she wrote a book that was about like a 70s radical who was living underground. She wrote a book about a rock musician who was like writing a memoir about the life he wished he'd had that he didn't really have. They're a little bit more, they're all really quirky and interesting. But this book is about, you know, a middle-aged woman about to hit menopause, lying awake at night, worrying about the state of the world and her marriage. It just feels like, it's still, you know, maybe a specific audience, but maybe a larger specific audience.
I don't know. That sounds too close to the bone for me. But yeah. but I like the idea of the rock musician who's writing the memoir that he wished he lived. So thank you.
Sure.
Lori's pick for the week is Wayward by Dana Spiotta. Thank you, Lori, for that choice. And finally, we've got a wild card from Johanna. Johanna, what have you chosen for us?
Yes, I'm so excited to talk about this book. I'm a huge Rachel Cusk fan, and she recently came out with a book called Second Place, a novel. I find that she just has such a great sense of humor. I think her characters are always incredibly sharply observed and rendered, and I think that very much holds true for this book, which really is telling the story of a couple at sort of a pivot, a moment of change in their lives. They live in this cabin they've built in the countryside near a marsh, and there's a narrator who only goes by M and her husband Tony, and they're happy together, but she's also sort of searching for an adventure. She's kind of seeking something, and she invites this very sort of enigmatic and talented visual artist who goes by L to come and stay with her. And he arrives with a female friend, sort of a girlfriend, sort of just a friend. It's never really clear. She's obviously unannounced, and at first she's kind of hilariously rude, but she quickly befriends the narrator's daughter, who's also staying in the cabin with them, and becomes ultimately much more sympathetic than Elle, who harbors this kind of mysterious hatred for the narrator. And we're seeing them kind of have this power struggle and kind of grapple with each other throughout the course of the novel. Throughout all of this, we also see Brett, who's Elle's girlfriend, and Justine, the narrator's daughter, getting closer. And that kind of leads to some really beautiful passages about, I guess, M sort of seeing her daughter blossom and grow and mature in a new way. There's a really beautiful passage. She says, Justine was 21 years old that spring, and in many ways she was revealing herself to be not at all who I had believed her to be, while at the same time reminding me unexpectedly of other people I had known. And then later she says, something in her growing independence tore at my heartstrings. It almost felt like the less I had to worry about, the sadder I became. I loved Justine, as it were, self-critically. I was working somehow to free her from myself when it appeared that what she needed was to take some of me with her. So there are these really beautiful moments of tenderness with her daughter, and you're seeing her kind of deal with the separation, and at the same time as she's dealing with this real force who is this artist. So I there's very funny moments, there's very touching moments, and I think there's also kind of a bit of a surrealism that pervades the whole book, and it's a real treat to read.
You make it sound so good, Johanna. I've been feeling guilty about Rachel Cusk for about the last, 30 years, because I read her first novel, Saving Agnes, when it came out. And it was, talk about books that are aimed at a particular audience. That one is about a woman in her 20s who's living in London, working in publishing. And I was a woman in my 20s living in New York, working in publishing. And I really didn't like it. And it's hard to remember exactly why I didn't get along with it. And I haven't read one of her books since. And they all sound so great. And they sound like I would love them. But then I think to myself, well, that one sounded like I would love it too. So I haven't gotten over that hurdle. But maybe you'll push me to read this one.
Do it. Get over the hurdle for sure. It's well worth it. I totally understand that. And when something resonates, so it seems like it's speaking so strongly to me in a strange way or in an off way, I completely understand that that's can be off-putting. But for this one, it's also has kind of nothing to do with really anything. It's so abstract. She's kind of just out here in the middle of the marsh. And it's really lovely.
Johanna's pick for the week is Second Place by Rachel Cusk. Thank you, Johanna, for that choice.
No problem.
Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Britta Lundin, author of Like Other Girls, a YA novel in which a girl goes out for her high school football team in a small Oregon town and inadvertently foments a political movement. You will not want to miss it. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.